Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963 was a turning point in modern American history. In today's program, we're going to examine the possible role of the CIA in President Kennedy's murder. So please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts. A farewell to justice. Welcome back to History Counts. Since the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, there's only been one criminal prosecution for his murder, and that case was brought in 1967 by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who believed that U.S. intelligence agencies were involved in the crime. Our guest today, Professor Joan Mellon, is the author of A Farewell to Justice. In her book, she not only tells the story of the Garrison prosecution, but also presents evidence uncovered in recent years which she believes supports the charge that the CIA played an important role in President Kennedy's murder. Professor Mellon, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ken.
John F. Kennedy was shot to death in Dallas, Texas. How and when did Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, become involved in the case?
President Kennedy was murdered on a Friday. On that same day, there was a character in New Orleans named Jack Martin. And Jack Martin went around to everyone who would listen, that means the media and also the district attorney's office, and said that someone he knew in New Orleans, who was a CIA contract pilot named David Ferry, knew Lee Harvey Oswald very well. And Garrison listened to this, and his office called David Ferry in for questioning. And eventually on Monday morning, Ferry turned himself in, and Garrison's office interrogated him. And they asked him about whether he knew Oswald, and Ferry denied that he knew Oswald. And Garrison, at that point, turned Ferry over to the FBI and the Secret Service.
What did the FBI do with Ferry?
The FBI questioned Ferry. Ferry lied. In fact, one of the things that Ferry said was he hadn't been in Dallas in 8 years. And one of the things that I discovered, and Garrison never really fully established this, was that Ferry had gone to Dallas the week before the assassination. He had rented an airplane because his own airplane was not what they call airworthy. And so he flew to Dallas that very week, and he lied about it.
Did the FBI follow up with Ferry, or did they
No.
let him go?
And the FBI let him go. The Secret Service let him go. And in fact, at one point there, the FBI told the Secret Service that they were no longer be needed in the investigation. So the FBI took over, this was under the auspices, of course, of J. Edgar Hoover at the time, took over the investigation entirely.
And so Garrison was out of the picture at that point.
Garrison was out of the picture, and he had no desire to be in the picture. And it was a couple of years past, 1965. The Warren Commission in this intervening period has been established. The former CIA director, Alan Dulles, is the foremost figure on this Warren Commission.
Now, the Warren Commission came to what conclusion?
The Warren Commission came to the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald had murdered President Kennedy alone, without Confederates, and that he was an unstable individual, and that's why he did it.
And what was the press reaction to the Warren Commission report?
The press rubber-stamped it.
But now there was an article that appeared in Esquire, though, that did perk Garrison's interest in the case again.
That's right. Dwight McDonald was a very big literary figure at the time. He did a piece for Esquire magazine reviewing the Warren Report, and he was very interested in McDonald's article. And as soon as he read that, he gave it to his assistant, John Voles, and he said, read this. And at that moment, Garrison's interest in the case was revived, and he said, after all, it happened in my jurisdiction, by which he meant that the assassination plans were implemented in the state of Louisiana prior to the events in Dallas.
And then he had a conversation with a member of the Warren Commission.
That's right. Garrison happened to travel to Washington, where he ran into a political confederate of his own, who was Louisiana Representative Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs was on the Warren Commission, and Hale Boggs was told by Alan Dulles, tell no one anything of what happened in our executive sessions behind closed doors. Hale Boggs disregarded this and told Jim Garrison that the Warren Commission had discovered Lee Harvey Oswald had been working for the FBI. And that right away raised questions, because Oswald was supposed to be this lone assassin, this nut, and here we see that he's working for a major government agency, an intelligence agency.
Garrison wrote a book about his case called On the Trail of the Assassins, and he said in it, quote, who actually pulled the triggers had never interested me as much as who organized, paid for, and benefited from the assassination of John F. Kennedy, end quote. That was the perspective that he approached it. But he was also aware that Oswald was not the lone gunman. He was aware of the logistical problems, the witnesses on the grassy knoll, the nitrate tests that showed Oswald didn't shoot a gun that day. He was aware of that, but he still just wanted to focus in another area.
He thought that the real issue behind the Kennedy assassination, and I think we would have to agree with him, is who planned the crime. Not who the hired gunmen were, but rather could he find evidence that would indicate who had the most to gain, who wanted President Kennedy out of the way, and who could have really engineered the cover-up. One of the most important truths of the Garrison investigation, that the cover-up involving the framing of Lee Harvey Oswald occurred in those cities of Clinton and Jackson, north of Baton Rouge, months prior to the shooting in November.
Well, now this gets us into his examination of the Warren Commission material and coming across a pamphlet with the address 544 Camp on it. Can you tell us what was going on in the building at that location?
One of the things that Garrison established was that the pamphlets that Lee Harvey Oswald was giving had the address 544 Camp Street, which was the side door of a building at 531 Lafayette Street, which was the office of a former special agent in charge in Chicago named Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister was an extreme right-winger. He was in favor of all the sovereignty commissions and all the efforts to prevent integration in the state of Louisiana. And Guy Bannister was also the paymaster for CIA training camps against Castro north of Lake Pontchartrain. And people who frequented Guy Bannister's office were David Ferry, whom we mentioned earlier, Jack Martin, the first person who told the Garrison office about the relationship between Ferry and Oswald, and Lee Harvey Oswald himself. Now, Guy Bannister at one point realized that Oswald had been giving out those pamphlets with the 544 Camp Street address, and he told him to stop, so he only did it once. And somebody asked him, and he said, well, he's one of us. So here's Guy Bannister, who's with CIA affiliations, with Office of Naval Intelligence connections, being close and giving Lee Harvey Oswald the second floor of his office to store his pamphlets and really use as an office.
Now, Bannister had been involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion himself?
Bannister had been involved in raising money for the Bay of Pigs and for, you know, sending vehicles to Cuba, I believe, and this sort of thing. In the years following the failure of the Bay of Pigs, these training camps continued because of the anti-Castro movement was still going on after the Bay of Pigs.
Well, now,
Bannister was in the middle of all of that.
Now the Bay of Pigs does relate directly to the motivation to remove Kennedy. Could you tell about the conflict between John F. Kennedy and the Central Intelligence Agency?
John F. Kennedy never really wanted to go through with this Bay of Pigs operation, which had begun under President Eisenhower. And at the last minute, he almost just decided not to do. And what he finally did was not to use the full air cover that had been intended. And the CIA came to President Kennedy and said, listen, we're going to be defeated here. We need ground forces to invade Cuba at the same time. We need full support. And President Kennedy refused it. After the Bay of Pigs, of course, he fires Allen Dulles, and he fires Dulles's second-in-command, who's General Charles Cabell, whose brother turns out to be mayor of Dallas at the time of the Kennedy assassination. And after that, the CIA and President Kennedy are really at war.
He takes other steps against them, doesn't he? Start to review their covert operations and do things like remove the U-2 program from their jurisdiction. And
he tried. He tried to take away many of the powers of the Director of Central Intelligence.
Well, now, the CIA had a record under Allen Dulles, who was fired by Kennedy, of covert operations overthrowing governments and committing assassinations. Guatemala in 54, Iran in 53, I believe.
CIA is running its own policy. In fact, President Truman wrote that famous op-ed piece on the front page of the Washington Post a month after the Kennedy assassination, in which he wrote that the CIA was running a shadow government and that they were out of control and had to be stopped.
And they also had done recent assassinations, I believe, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic and
Diem in Vietnam.
Diem in Vietnam, which took place in 63, just before John F. Kennedy was shot. And I think they were implicated in the murder of Patrice Lumumba.
That's right. I don't think they actually achieved it, but they were close, and all across the board. We see them later in 1975, I think, in Chile with President Allende. So there they are committing these assassinations and having created this capability of assassination.
Now, Jack Martin has placed Lee Harvey Oswald in Bannister's office and David Ferry there as well.
Jack Martin placed Ferry and Oswald as being very close, and Ferry denied it, but in fact, Oswald was a member of the Civil Air Patrol troop that was run by David Ferry in the 1950s.
So that goes way back.
And in fact, when Jack Martin was interviewed by Garrison, when Garrison began his investigation in earnest, Jack Martin said, you know, there's a photograph of Ferry and Oswald together at a cookout. And Garrison just sort of let it go because they didn't have the photograph. Years later, in the 1990s, this photograph emerges, and the Civil Air Patrol cadet, John Sirivolo, produces a photograph of a cookout. There's Ferry at one point, and Oswald is standing there with them all.
Lee Harvey Oswald, then, is not the man that he's portrayed as being by the Warren Commission. Turns out he has a much different past. Can you tell us something about his military career, his connection with the U-2 program?
Oswald was, of course, very familiar with the U-2 at Atsugi in Japan when he had high security clearances, which led people to believe that perhaps he was the person who went over to the Soviets when he so-called defected and gave them the information that led to the downing of the U-2 and Francis Gary Powers. One of the things that I discovered in my research was that Oswald not only worked for the CIA, which was he was part of the false defector program going into the Soviet Union, organized by CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton. Not only did he work for the FBI, but Oswald also worked for U.S. Customs. And the depositions of the U.S. Customs officers, they would depose before the Church Committee in the mid-1970s, and those depositions are still closed to this day. And the reason we have the information is that the summaries of the depositions somehow managed to become public. So we see in the summaries that Oswald worked for Customs, too. And this is not surprising, because very often in those years, the CIA and Customs exchanged agents.
Oswald is in Russia as a defector. Apparently, he makes a dramatic announcement at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in 1959 that his allegiance is now to Russia, not to the United States. Here's a former Marine. It must have received some publicity. And then about a year later, he comes back. How did that happen?
Well, Oswald came back to the United States courtesy of the State Department, which paid his way and made him a loan, which is sort of unheard of for a defector. You know, he was not a defector. And in fact, people have often asked, well, how come he wasn't debriefed if he was a CIA plant? And in fact, we have new evidence, new documents that have come out in the year 2006, which reveal that Oswald was, in fact, debriefed. There's no question that he was part of that false defector program.
So Oswald comes back to the United States. He's supposedly a traitor, but the State Department brings him back, and his first job is with a Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans. What kind of place is that?
One of the things that really benefited me and many others enormously was the passage of the JFK Act in 1992, which was a result of letters written to Congress by people who had seen Oliver Stone's film JFK and said, if Oliver Stone is wrong, open the files. So open go the files, and we find all kinds of information, such as the fact that the head of the Riley Coffee Company has two different kinds of CIA clearances. And what Garrison concluded after looking at all of this, there was no one with whom Oswald was associated who was not with the CIA.
So he spends a short time there, and then he goes to New Orleans to Dallas. And what kind of a job is he given in Dallas, Texas?
Well, one of the interesting facts that have come out and that people know about is that Oswald's job at the Texas School Book Depository is at a place. That building is owned by a man named D.H. Byrd. D.H. Byrd happens to be a person who was a defense contractor, and after President Kennedy is killed and Lyndon Johnson sends all the ground forces into Vietnam, Byrd's companies, which had been doing poorly, suddenly are overwhelmingly successful and rich. So you can see that the people who benefited by the Kennedy assassination, it's not that the CIA was acting alone. The CIA was acting on behalf of the defense industries of the West and the Pentagon. So the Pentagon and the CIA, they're operating together on behalf of Western defense industries, Bell Helicopter, oil, and in fact, industries in which the Bush family have a great deal of interest. For example, D.H. Byrd was associated with some of the benefactors of George Walker Bush.
I think you mentioned
Herbert Walker Bush, the father.
Dresser Industries?
Yes, yes.
And there's some tie-in to Brown and Root?
That's right. And, of course, Brown and Root, then, are also the great supporters of Lyndon Johnson. One of the things that Garrison wanted to do was to call George Brown in for questioning. And what he found, no, Garrison did not find this, but what we find among the documents, the 4 million documents that have accumulated in the National Archives, is that George Brown had CIA connections, and there are CIA documents talking about him. We see a whole series of CIA-connected people who are handling Oswald from the time that he returns from the Soviet Union. In Louisiana, the person who handled Oswald and was the person who took him around was a person named Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw was the person whom Garrison put on trial as part of the conspiracy to kill President Kennedy.
How and why is Lee Harvey Oswald brought back to New Orleans?
Oswald comes back to New Orleans. And he's come back to the city of his birth, after
all. This is like April of 63,
in April of 1963. And during the course of that summer, we find Lee Harvey Oswald associating with David Ferry and Clay Shaw. The most important of those incidents occurs when David Ferry and Shaw, and I should say that Shaw has a long background in military intelligence, and in fact Shaw was the managing director of the International Trade Mart, which was a CIA project, and it was the first of these international trade marts in New Orleans. So here's Clay Shaw, the most unlikely social confederate or friend or whatever word we want to use here's Clay Shaw, who's a socialite, who goes out with the high society of uptown New Orleans, is suddenly seen driving up to Clinton and Jackson with Ferry, who in his wig, who looks like an outlandish character, and Oswald.
Although Shaw denied knowing Oswald, the Clinton trip was extremely important connecting Shaw to Oswald.
Well, it was very important, and you had black and white witnesses, and at this time in Louisiana, these people would never talk to each other.
There's no question at this point about Clay Shaw's connections to the CIA. Is that right?
Well, now, that was during Garrison's time, it was more difficult. But since the passage of the JFK Act, Clay Shaw's file, his personnel file, has been released. And so we see that Clay Shaw did jobs for the CIA, not only for domestic contact, as some people have claimed, but rather he worked for the Office of Security, and he was really involved in operations. His files reside in the place where operations occurred. And when we look at the reports of Shaw's efforts for the CIA, we find that he's not just being debriefed, as has been said. What's written there is that Shaw was told such and such, please find out such and such, do this, do that, and he was involved very much in the political involvements and activities of Argentina, Peru, various countries. So we have all those reports. He was involved in very high-level CIA operations involving Cuba.
And Shaw is the only one indicted in 1967. Why aren't Bannister and Ferry part of the defendants?
Well, that's an easy one. Guy Bannister died in 1964, and of course it was ruled a heart attack, but so there were witnesses that said that he had been shot. David Ferry died in February of 1967, just before Garrison was about to charge him.
There's an expression that's used in the book, sheep-dipping, for what was happening to Oswald while he was in New Orleans. What is sheep-dipping?
Sheep-dipping means giving you another identity. And in other words, Oswald was sheep-dipped as pro-Castro. There he is on the streets of New Orleans giving out leaflets that say, fair play for Cuba, pro-Castro. And I think what we see there is that the original plan of the CIA was to blame Castro for the assassination of President Kennedy. At some point, they changed their minds and they decided it's too complicated, because here was Castro, after all, involved with President Kennedy's emissaries in seeking rapprochement, seeking to make friends with the United States. Kennedy had sent down his friend William Atwood, and they were involved in those negotiations. It would be impossible to prove that Castro really was behind the assassination. Before that, the idea was that Oswald would be shown to be someone who was working for Castro and trying to help him, and therefore giving out these leaflets, and on behalf of Castro, killed President Kennedy as retaliation for all the efforts of the CIA to attempt to kill Castro.
So he was reinvented and then returned to Dallas.
He was. And so who was he? When Oswald is arrested in Dallas, he asks even for a Communist Party lawyer named John Apt. What he's doing is signaling to his CIA handlers and bosses, and he's saying, listen, I'm still with the program. You told me to pretend to be a communist, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Now, of course, Oswald's shot by Jack Ruby, and I was surprised that Jack Ruby was not just a mobster who, for some unknown reason, shot Oswald, but he also was involved with anti-Castro Cubans, was he not?
Well, yes, he was. The CIA's own Inspector General's report of 1967 reveals is that the CIA enlisted mafia people in their attempts to kill Castro. We know that. Johnny Roselli, Sam Giancana, Santo Traficante. So it's not surprising that Jack Ruby, with his mob connections, would also be tapped as a person that the CIA could use in the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. One of the things I discovered in my book, and there were other examples, many examples of the fact that Ruby knew Oswald well.
Ruby knew Oswald. How was that?
One of my best witnesses, Thomas Edward Beckham, said that at the day of the assassination of Oswald, when Oswald is killed, he says, how could Jack do that to Lee?
Ruby had an employee who said that Oswald was at Ruby's office?
That's Dago Garner. That's a witness that Garrison didn't use at the trial of Clay Shaw, and I regretted it later because Dago Garner, who was sort of a hanger-on, one of these people at the Jack Ruby's club, the Carousel Club, saw Shaw there, he saw Oswald there, and Garrison decided not to use him at the trial because Garrison decided that he would not use anyone as a witness who had a criminal record.
Another shocker to me was to learn about Julia Mercer. And what did she say about
Julia Mercer was just an innocent bystander who was driving along on the morning of the assassination. She sees a truck and she sees someone get out and bring something that looked like guns or guns in a bag up the grassy knoll. And she identified the driver of that vehicle as Jack Ruby. And her statements were falsified and denied, and the FBI interviewed her maybe four or five times. She kept to her story. And she even turned over the photograph at one point that she was shown, and it said Jack Ruby on the back. So it was certainly Ruby whom she saw. And she was vilified. She was terrified. Garrison finally decided not to use her also because she was so frightened. When he asked the House Select Committee to find Julianne Mercer in the 1970s when they were doing their investigation, they just never followed up, which, of course, that was no investigation at all. That was a CIA-controlled false investigation.
And people, witnesses, did have a reason to be afraid.
Oh, yes. Well, with Ferry's death was ruled a suicide, but it's very unclear. You know, the suicide notes were typed, and the cause of death is difficult to determine.
There's also the case I read about of J. Garrett Underhill, the life editor who told friends that the CIA killed Kennedy.
That's right, and he suddenly dies. I think he's shot in his bed.
Yeah, bullet in his head in 1964.
And then there's a whole list of these people.
Garrison had problems getting cooperation from the government with his prosecution, didn't he?
Well, he had a lot of it. First of all, the Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office always worked in cooperation with the local FBI, and so they were shocked when the FBI was obviously following them, surveilling them, wiretapping their phones, and not helping them at all. And at first they were incredulous, and in fact, when I found the document from J. Edgar Hoover saying, give Garrison nothing, Garrison's chief investigator, Louis Ivon, said, I'd like to see that. Because it was really amazing to them that they had to fight with the FBI, and the FBI was investigating Garrison's office rather than investigating the Kennedy assassination. By the time Garrison's investigation begins, huge efforts are made by media assets of the CIA to attack Garrison, to accuse him of sexual exploits, to accuse him of bribing witnesses, to accuse him of having witnesses beat, everything you can think of to try to obstruct. And some people whom Garrison subpoenaed to the grand jury lied because they felt that the CIA would protect them.
In fact, a memo surfaced from the CIA's files countering criticism of the Washington Warren Commission.
In April of 1967, there was a CIA memo which is countering criticism of the Warren Report, given the timing of it of April 1967. That was the middle of the Garrison investigation. So we can see that this was designed, what people in the media should say, should anyone could, and of course it's referring to Garrison. So the CIA controlled exactly how Garrison was going to be reported on.
And this included very substantial publications like Newsweek, Time, the New York Times.
And in fact, the CIA also sent down a so-called Saturday Evening Post writer named James Phelan, who involved himself in trying to subvert Garrison's chief witness, Perry Russo. Perry Russo manages to stand up to this constant barrage of attempts to bribe him, to threaten him, should he not renege and not testify for Garrison.
This effort to discredit Garrison continued until recently. There was an article by Max Holland in The Nation regarding Garrison's investigation, was there not?
Well, why do they need to do that? I mean, one could only come to the conclusion that maybe they know he was right.
His prosecution was not successful.
Clay Shaw is acquitted. And I think that Clay Shaw got on the stand and lied. Garrison did not have enough proof to be able to say for a fact that Clay Shaw worked for the CIA. We have that information now. He really was relying on the association of Clay Shaw with Oswald, and who of course wasn't even the assassin, but was framed to do that, and also from a conversation that Clay Shaw had with David Ferry, witnessed by Perry Russo shortly, maybe a few months before the assassination, in which Clay Shaw discusses what his alibi is going to be for November 22nd, and David Ferry discusses what his alibi is going to be, and both turn out to be true. Shaw was going to be in San Francisco visiting a fellow CIA asset called Monroe Sullivan at the International Trademark equivalent in San Francisco, and Ferry was going to be at a college outside New Orleans. It turns out to be true, and that reveals that both Ferry and Shaw, of course, had foreknowledge of the assassination. There was no question that there was a conspiracy in the murder of President Kennedy.
Shaw
did say that.
Shaw is acquitted, but now as the evidence comes out, it appears that the connections to higher-level CIA officials, such as David Attlee Phillips, may be there. Could you talk about him?
Well, David Attlee Phillips was the person who was the mastermind of the overthrowing of President Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. He was the great propaganda expert for the CIA, and he was also the CIA officer who was masterminding the infiltration, because Fair Play for Cuba was an organization, the CIA infiltration of Fair Play for Cuba. So, and Phillips is also involved in organizing some of these training camps. So really, he's everywhere when we look at this case. And in fact, he's even seen in with Lee Harvey Oswald by another CIA asset named Antonio Veciana in Dallas now.
That was established
by Gayton Fonzie, who was the investigator of the Cubans for the House Select Committee.
Yes.
So this is big. Now, who does David Attlee Phillips work for? Well, we can trace the CIA aspects, and it's pretty clear that it's the clandestine service that's involved here in the planning of the assassination, and it goes up to Richard Helms. And this has come out in a whole variety of ways. Another CIA asset named Richard K. Snagel, in some of his letters, reveals that it was Helms behind the assassination.
Well, Phillips himself appeared in a film at Lake Pontchartrain, I understand?
Yes, there was some footage taken of one of the training camps, and that was witnessed by Bob Tannenbaum, who worked as the deputy counsel for the House Select Committee, and there we see David Attlee Phillips, we see Ferry, we see Oswald training in one of these training camps.
Now, you mentioned Richard Helms, who was director of the CIA from 1966 to 73. In 1963, he was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency's covert operations.
That's right. He was DDP, Deputy Director for Plans, which is the clandestine service. It's not only an individual, it also represented what they called the Dirty Tricks Department.
Now, also Howard Hunt, the famous Watergate burglar, has some connection here, which came out in a libel lawsuit. Could you tell us about
Howard
Hunt?
Well, that's a very interesting story. Victor Marchetti was a CIA agent who actually left the agency and wrote a book called The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. And Victor Marchetti wrote an article for the Liberty Lobby's magazine, which is Spotlight, in which he said that the CIA planned to let E. Howard Hunt hang out. In other words, they were going to give him up and say that he had been involved, he'd been in Dallas. And so Hunt sued the Liberty Lobby and Spotlight and Marchetti, and Mark Lane represented the Liberty Lobby in that case. And what Mark Lane did there was to prove, pretty much, I think, that Hunt was in Dallas on the day of the assassination.
Well, you said, I quote, "The present state of our political culture is a direct result of the fact that those responsible for the murder of President Kennedy have never been brought to justice."
End quote. I believe that. I mean, democracy is not something that we have and will always be there for us. We have to fight and defend it. You know, some people don't want to live in a country where the CIA murdered the president.
You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Professor Joan Mellon about her book, A Farewell to Justice, in which she presents evidence of the possible role of the CIA in President Kennedy's assassination in 1963. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.